With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shape Us, now out in paperback. If you like book chat, you might like our newsletter, Further Reading. You can find it at furtherreading.substack.com. I'm so excited to share this episode with you. This is a conversation with one of my very favourite writers, Curtis Sittenfeld, to celebrate the publication of the hotly anticipated new novel Rodham, a fictionalised account of the life of Hillary Clinton and what could have happened if she'd broken up with Bill and gone on to become president. Rodham by Curtis Sittenfeld is published by Doubleday and it's available in ebook and audio on May the 19th. And it's available to pre-order in hardback and the hardback's coming in July. Curtis and I talked about short stories, first ladies, literary audacity and borrowing from Jane Austen.
Firstly, I want to tell you how much I adored Rodham and how captivating and immersive I found it. Also, weirdly, it was like it was what I was reading right when everything sort of shut up. And so I felt like I was sort of in this very, very specific world. Did you always know that Rodham was sort of a novel that was inside you and had to come out? Or did you start kind of experimenting and exploring with that voice and think you had more to say?
I would say definitely the latter. So I did not think that there was a Hillary novel inside me all this time. And so editors from the American Esquire, you know, like the American version of Esquire magazine, reached out to me in early 2016 and said, do you want to write a story from the perspective of Hillary Clinton when she's being nominated, to be the sort of presidential, the Democratic presidential candidate? And so it basically fell in my lap. And I don't think that's a story I would have written on my own. And I even had reservations about accepting the assignment, but then I thought, oh, why not? So it ran, probably 5 months before the American election when things, you know, it was predicted that she would win. And that story is very straightforward. Like it never names her, but it's told in the first person and the kind of facts that there's stuff is made up about a way that she interacts with a journalist, but the sort of, you know, it talks about countries she visited as Secretary of State or like having a vegan husband or things like that. So I did have that experience of, you know, writing from her perspective, which in itself felt kind of radical because I had declined invitations to write essays about her. And I thought, I don't have anything to say about Hillary Clinton that hasn't already been said at some point in the last, you know, almost 30 years. But then I thought when the question was not like, what do people think of Hillary, but what does Hillary think of people? Then it turned out I had a lot to say. So, you know, that was part of, I think, what made me write it. And then also I had this kind of slow realization that I feel like it almost coalesced more after the election than before, that for a lot of American school children, they know who Hillary is. They knew who she was. They knew she was running for president, but they actually didn't know who Bill Clinton was. They didn't know that he was Hillary's husband, and they didn't know that that he had been, you know, president and had all this baggage associated with him. So I think it was kind of the fact of having written the story combined with that realization about, like, you know, and sort of wondering, well, what would it be like if American adults had the same perspective of Hillary as separate from Bill that that children do?
The experience of reading that story kind of post Me Too, because I guess when I was growing up, I think I was 12, 13-ish when, and you know, I heard it kind of at a remove. I imagine that the way it was reported in the UK was a little different and it wasn't quite so full on, you know, and it felt pretty full on here, but sort of, I don't know if it kind of sounded glamorous and scandalous for shame, the treatment of women and the, you know, misogyny in the reporting and the sort of, you know, the casual disregard for sort of a, you know, a woman's experience. And it, you know, when I heard those first stories when I was 12, I wasn't thinking, how dare they say that about these people? Obviously, you know, coming to it again and you realise, or I realised just how much I was sort of internalized from that time and, you know, hadn't questioned enough.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I think I had this sort of, you know, eye-opening experience with regard to Hillary when in 2007, I read her first memoir, Living History, because I was writing American Wife. And so, and American Wife is loosely based on Laura Bush. So I was just kind of reading Living History. I just thought, you know, Hillary lived in the White House recently. She was first lady. Like, that was my motive. And when I read it, I did think, because, I mean, I'm definitely a Democrat. You know, I guess when Bill Clinton was first elected, I couldn't vote, but I'm sure I voted for him, you know, this second time he ran for president. But I had really liked them when they first kind of came on the scene in 1991, 92. And then my enthusiasm for both of them waned, where it just felt like there was scandal after scandal while they were in the White House. And when I read Living History, which was, you know, 8 years or 7 or 8 years after they'd left the White House, I did have this moment of thinking to myself, why do I see them almost as the same person? Or, you know, like, and also there's all these kind of rumors or it's not like kind of like stereotypes that affix themselves to her, or like kind of talking points that don't really necessarily have that much to do with like the way she spent most of her time over like the decades, and you know, the issues that she's focused on, and she's, I mean, I think she's a very substantive, smart, serious person, and like somehow we just end up talking about her hair all the time, and it's a little bit preposterous.
There's something so weird, isn't there, about how in the flattening, you know, if you're a woman, the only thing worse than being someone who is sort of sexualized is someone who is not sexualized, you know, that you only get to be one or the other. And so that kind of like, well, you know, if she's like not one of the hot women who Bill is cheating on her with, then she must be the shrew. And it's so overwhelming and, you know, and unfair. But I think in real life, and, you know, what I took away from your book was it's that making the love interest sort of becomes the hero. And I'm wondering whether you remember reading any books kind of growing up or in general where there's a, you know, someone who's kind of in there as the partner of the hero, and you think, oh, I'd like to give them more of a voice, and I'd, you know, I'd like someone to tell their story as a main narrative.
I mean, I do think that there's something that's almost a little bit more interesting. Like, I don't think, well, okay, so, you know, my book American Wife is written from the perspective of a first lady. And so I think it's fair that some people have said to me, like, what's your obsession with first ladies? And I don't really think I have an obsession with first ladies. Like, I think of Hillary, I don't think of her as primarily a first lady, even though she was one. You know, I think of her as a presidential candidate or secretary of state. I mean, like, I could make a case for that a person who's in the orbit of a very famous person in some ways is more interesting to me than a very famous person, because it's almost like, I don't know, like if you're the very famous person, everything is, you know, sort of swirling around you. You are the sun. And if you're just like you, it's almost like you can have this invisibility. If you're not in the limelight directly, you can have this invisibility, or kind of, you know, like you're sort of famous, but you're sort of a regular person, or you're, and it's, that weirdness is actually interesting to me, in some ways more interesting than a person who kind of seeks out their own fame.
To go to the books, are you reading much in these times? Are you kind of reaching for books as a comfort, or finding it harder to concentrate? What are you reading at the moment?
Well, I think because, you know, like you, books are sort of, it's almost like my hobby and my job. And so I am always reading. You know, like I just was in conversation with the writer. Like I just did a sort of online event that was, of course, supposed to be an in-person event and got adjusted, but with the writer Emily Gould, who had written the book Perfect Tunes. Is that on your radar?
Yes. Oh, Emily Gould, who runs, is it Emily Books?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
she famously wrote a memoir, and she wrote this really incredible essay about money that I think about all the time, about what it's like to sort of get this huge advance and think it's going to change your life as a writer, and then...
Yeah. She's really interesting. And the new book, it's about a young woman. I'm trying to think of how to describe it without any spoilers, who, you know, is like, she wants to be a musician and songwriter, and she's talented. And then her career as it's beginning gets kind of interrupted. And then it sort of follows her over 15 years in this interesting way. So it's like a really smart book and a really readable book. So I just read that.
What's it called?
Oh, sorry. It's called Perfect Tunes.
Perfect Tunes.
Yeah. And I've actually seen, I love the UK cover. I've seen the UK cover online somewhere. I am about to start reading the new Lily King book. Do you know, I think it's called, I feel like I mix up this title, but I think it's called Writers and Lovers. Is that on your, maybe it's called Lovers and Writers.
I don't know her, but that's a great, great title.
She wrote Euphoria, that's like a sort of fictionalized Margaret Mead story. So basically several writers have recommended her new book to me, which I think is about a young woman. And I think it maybe takes place like 20 or 30 years ago, who's like a waitress becoming a writer. And supposedly the details of being a writer are very good. I still haven't read, but it's at the top of my list, Trust Exercise by Susan Choi. Have you read that one?
I keep hearing about it.
Yeah, people, same. It's on my bookshelf. So yeah, I mean, I don't only read new stuff, but you know, obviously when everybody's talking about something new, it's kind of intriguing.
And often I think if you're getting sent a lot of stuff, it ends up rising to the top. Doesn't it? Just sort of piles and piles and piles.
I see the piles behind you, literally.
And this is just a room. It's not even a flat anymore. It's just books. Can you remember the first book you read that felt like your own discovery? That was sort of it. You know, when you have that feeling when you think, this is just for me.
It's funny. I remember reading in high school. The first time I read a short story in The New Yorker, and it was by Deborah Eisenberg, and it was about two teenage girls, or maybe one of them was like an adult looking back on being a teenage girl. And I you know, my parents had always subscribed to The New Yorker, and I had, you know, looked at the covers and looked at the cartoons. And I think I thought, oh, like, that's what's in here. That's all the stuff that's like not the imagery, but it's the words. And I was kind of riveted. And I think, you know, and I still remember a few other New Yorker stories that I read very, very early on, including there was one by Catherine Webber. And just kind of, you know, like it felt like this window into adulthood, or into the adult perspective. And, but it just was very intriguing to me.
I think what's so exciting is when you first read a story when at a formative time, when there's some ambiguity and it doesn't have a, and that's the end, but it's just, there's a messiness to it that feels very adult and thrilling.
Yeah, I think that is true, that it was sort of like what am I supposed to take away from this, and not being sure made it more rather than less interesting.
Are you from a family of readers? Was everyone in the house reading the fiction in the New Yorker? Were there sort of books on the shelf that you'd pull out and pick up?
So it's funny, that's a complicated question. I mean, I think the short answer is yes, in the sense that there were lots of books in my house growing up. And, you know, when I was, I'm one of four siblings. And when I was, you know, like 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever, like my parents would read aloud, and we read to our whole family, we read like the Laura Ingalls Wilder books or things like that. And there's, my mother was an art history teacher. And so we always had lots of like sort of coffee table art books. But actually, I would say that I am by far the biggest reader in my family. So I think that, like, I don't think that anyone else routinely ever read the fiction in the New Yorker, or, you know, like they might on occasion, but that's not the default. Yeah, I think my mother, you know, my mother is usually reading some book. I think that I would say she reads more nonfiction than fiction. I mean, my dad, I would almost say, is more of a magazine reader. And so now in adulthood, my siblings, like one of my sisters reads, she listens to the audio of a ton of essay collections by female celebrities. That's like her go-to. One of my other sisters, I would consider the members of my family very intelligent. My other sister, I would say she reads maybe one or two books a year. I mean, she works very long hours. She reads a ton of like newspaper articles. Like, there's some people I know where I kind of joke that like they don't read a novel unless I write it.
Oh, but that's great, though. You'd rather have that than the other way around.
You mean, that's true.
And you can truly say, you know, if you read one novel this year.
I know, that's true. Or one novel in this 3-year stretch. So it's not, I don't know, like I wouldn't say that we were a sort of super, super, this is a really long answer that I'm giving you, but I wouldn't say, like I think my family is very engaged in the world. And, you know, like sometimes maybe we subscribe to magazines like Vanity Fair or People or Newsweek or Time. And we subscribe to a lot of magazines. And at times when a magazine arrived in the mail, we would literally physically fight over it. So it's like I think my family has always had this great interest in the world, but we were not sitting around talking about Tolstoy, you know?
You know, Laura Ingalls Wilder will more than do. I loved those stories. Did they feel like a compelling American origin story? Did you find them kind of cozy or terrifying or boring? Or
I think both. Like, I think they're kind of cozy and terrifying. And I tried to read them to my kids, and there was a scene very early on where Pa was, I'm trying to think of what the verb is, like, it's not like butchering an animal, like there's a more there's a more euphemistic verb, but essentially butchering an animal. And like my kids basically were like, no, thank you. So, I think they read a little bit on their own, but I think my idea of motherhood was like, we will read every book in the series, you know, back to back. And, you know, you can't sort of force such things on your offspring.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because the things I remember, like, you know, tapping the maple tree and making the mm-hmm. butter and making it a lovely golden color. Mm-hmm. I don't remember, like, you know, bear wrestling an animal butchery.
Yeah, yeah.
Very selective memory.
Yeah, I think there's a mix. There's a mix. And there's also, I mean, I think that the books, I guess the way to say it is like there's more racism and like the commentary on race is like it, it it does, I mean, it's very safe to say it does not feel contemporary. I mean, as not that racism isn't itself contemporary, but it's like, you know, there'll be sentences where I would think like, I do not want to read that sentence aloud to my child, or like, I don't want to give my child the sense that that's like appropriate language.
That worldview is sort of being presented without question in that context, yeah, in that setting, yeah, is a bit jarring.
Yeah, yeah. There's also, did you ever read Caddy Woodlawn? It's very similar to Laura Ingalls Wilder.
I have a vague memory.
Although I think it's fiction, whereas I think Laura Ingalls Wilder is not fiction, or at least is not, it might be fiction, but it's not presented as fiction. You know, it's partly fictional. Yeah.
Are there any books that you're kind of really excited to share with your children, or is there anything that you have discovered through them and been pleasantly surprised by?
I mean, there are definitely books, like I loved, did you ever read The Boxcar Children? It was a series, but I only ever read the first one about these four siblings who lived in a like train car. So I remember reading that when my kids were younger. I mean, certainly a lot of the picture books, like I loved Eloise. I liked most of Dr. Seuss. I read with one of my kids, I read from the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. I read actually with one of my kids, I read, do you know, it's a YA book, Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda. Is that on your, it became a movie.
Oh, yes.
Called, I think called Dear Simon. It's so the premise is, it's these two boys who go to a high school in Atlanta. I mean, it's primarily told from the point of view of one boy whose name is Simon. And somehow, the technology is like explained in the book, they end up emailing each other. And I'm trying to remember, like Simon definitely doesn't know who he's emailing. And I can't remember if the person he's emailing knows who Simon is. I think he does, or maybe partway through he does. Anyway, but the boys both know that they are gay and that they go to the same high school. And so everywhere Simon goes, you know, during the day, he thinks like, is that my anonymous pen pal? And the emails themselves are in the book. And so it's essentially, it's like an epistolary novel, but it's just like really kind of romantic and funny and sweet and contemporary. And I loved it. I thought it's very, like you sort of feel as you're reading, you sort of feel like you're waiting to hear back from like the, you know, to get the next email. So it has that kind of suspense, probably isn't the right word, but just like if ever you've been impatient to hear from another person, it gives you that feeling vicariously.
Oh, well, to fangirl for a second, you know what I love so much about your books, the yearning is captured so so beautifully. I don't know anyone else who writes yearning when you really really like feel it, and you sort of, it inhabits your soul in the way that you think it's, you know, it is inhabiting their soul, that sort of longing and that.
Thank you very much. That's a good compliment. I feel like it's like a good and slightly embarrassing compliment, but I'll
it's
take
mean
it.
Of me to do that now, because you know, while I'm sort of looking at you, because now you've got to work out what to do with, you know, with one's face when one is. But all great books are about people trying to get something or someone they want, and it's rare to be convinced of the wanting in that way.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. That's a really interesting statement or insight. I do, it's funny because when my short story collection came out 2 years ago, a fair number of people would say to me, like, I don't usually like short stories, but I liked yours. Or like, the thing that I don't like about short stories is that you kind of get invested in one and then it's over, or like I never get invested in it, and then usually this was in the context of someone saying something nice, like, but that doesn't apply to you, and I would think to myself, like, if someone feels like my stories are different, you know, what could it be? I mean, I think a part of me of course thinks, just, you know, read more short stories, or like, have you ever read Alice Munro? But I actually think that it might be there's like a pretty efficient or quickly presented vulnerability in the stories. And I think not even on purpose, but I think some writers are almost like writing maybe again, consciously or subconsciously, in the hope that the reader will think that they, the writer, are like cool or have a good life or like have their act together. And so it's to like, and I think I really try to write in such a way where it's like, almost like saying, I don't care what you think of me, the writer. I'm just trying to serve the story.
I suppose about the kind of, to call it ventriloquism, doesn't seem like it's a, it sort of, it captures the fullness of it. But I guess it makes a lot of sense that you can, you know, because I think that you've really got to put yourself aside. And I would venture a suggestion that might not be true in a, to, you know, as I speak for all writers, you sort of, you start with yourself very much at the beginning, you know, in your first, one's first book or one's first go at any kind of fiction. And then you get, as you get more and more confident, you lose yourself and lose yourself. And so that's when you can sort of adopt another voice and another person so convincingly that it has been someone who sort of actually, you know, existed and been in the world.
I mean, I agree with the bulk of what you're saying. I think that, like, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's an evolution where like the beginning writer, you know, writes in her own voice and then evolves into writing from someone else's voice. I would almost say, like, I almost feel like it's a choice, because I do think there's some writers where I feel as if that writer, you know, over decades or over many books does write in the same voice pretty consistently. And then other people mix it up, and then some people sort of mix up the plot but maintain the voice. And so I think there are different approaches, but I think that if I were always writing from the point of view of a sort of thinly veiled version of myself, I think that would be pretty boring for me to write and potentially boring for readers to read.
You live your life in your life. You don't have to then sort of go to it like the the joy of what you do is that you get to try on all kinds of lives. Are there any authors that have really struck you in terms of how different their work is?
Yeah, no, it's funny. I would have to think to answer that question of who sort of, you know, mixes it up. I mean, it's a strange thing, because on the one hand, with my short story collection, I feel like those stories are pretty uniform in terms of like sensibility or like the demographic of, like, you know, it's mostly like educated, white, Midwestern American women, a lot of whom are kind of grumpy. And I feel like I almost felt like when I were younger, I might have thrown in stories from like with really different settings or from really different perspectives character-wise, just to show that I could. And when I was putting the book together, I thought, you know, if you want a story that's not about from the perspective of like an educated, grouchy white woman, just read a different collection. Like, there's plenty that are out there, and I don't need to put like science fiction in here, or I don't need to, just to show that I can, you know, or I don't need to like do something really formally experimental just to show that I can. I mean, it's like I could have done that if I wanted to, but if I didn't naturally have the impulse that I didn't think I should. So I think there is this way of like sort of striking a balance between writing in a way that's organic to the writer and sort of also pushing yourself to try new things.
Well, I think about someone like Elizabeth Strauss, and I wouldn't say there's anything especially comfortable or cozy about her universes, but you could. It would be very easy to say, well, everything feels very, very similar, but it's such that absolute close reading, you know, or someone's taking a microscope like under the grass, and it's sort of this tiny but a teeming universe full of different, and that you can have something that has that, I guess, a feeling of consistency, but there's so much sort of eclecticism within that. And I suppose it's the way we live, isn't it? And it's the side effect, I think, of being a sort of an educated, functioning person, the great, great gulf between what is said and what is meant and what is felt.
Ha! That's funny. No, I think there is, yeah, I think that gulf interests me a lot. And what you're saying, I think also makes me think of like Alice Munro and also Tessa Hadley, where I feel like you don't know what you'll get within a particular story or novel, but you don't know what the plot will be, but then you kind of have a handle on what the sensibility will probably be.
You know, I think of Tessa Hadley as the great polarizer, because I joke that my dream novel is like two people looking at each other across a lawn and thinking about sex, but maybe not having sex in real time. Give me a look where nothing happens. That's all I want. And I think that people either long for that. I think I'm in a minority, and other people, I want something to happen.
That is so funny. By the way, I have a recommendation for you. My super close friend from graduate school is named Susanna Daniel, and she's written two novels. One is called Stiltsville, and the other one is called Sea Creatures. And I, based on that description of what you most look for, I think they might be very much in your wheelhouse. Stiltsville and Sea Creatures. That's really funny.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
We'll be back to Curtis soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book that's even more precious than a diamond as big as the Ritz. This week, my steal is This Is Big, How the Founder of Weight Watchers Changed the World and Me by Marisa Meltzer. Marisa, the author, was put on her first diet when she was 5 years old. When she read an obituary for Jean Nidetch, the legendary founder of Weight Watchers, she felt a moment of intense connection. This Is Big is partly Marisa's memoir, partly Jean's biography, and entirely a wise, resonant, courageous, moving love letter to every single person who's ever cursed their complicated relationship with eating and their body. I devoured this. Marisa's voice is never anything less than compelling. She uses her great journalistic talent to strong effect. This is the thoughtful, nuanced, moving answer to anyone who has ever claimed the question of diet and exercise is an easy one. I gulped this down the first time around and I'm already longing to read it again. This Is Big is published by Chateau and Windus and out now. Now, back to Curtis.
I just read my first Sue Miller? No, is it Sue Miller?
Oh, yeah.
Monogamy.
I think that when I was a teenager, I read a bunch of her books and was kind of fascinated. Like, they have that sort of granular aspect of, you know, analyzing behavior and sort of being very interior in terms of, I mean, there's like external plots and there's like interior elements of like what people are thinking.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because I think that that's exactly what a certain sort of teen want. That I think that's very, very appealing to an obsessive teenage mindset, whereas people would be like, no, you want dinosaurs and spacemen.
I think this is true with TV and with books, that in a way the TV show or the writer kind of sets the reader or viewer's expectations. And so it's kind of like, you know, this is going to be very dramatic or this is not going to be very dramatic, but almost like the less that happens externally, the more, you know, two fingers brushing against each other are going to seem really exciting and suspenseful. And, but, you know, like, it's almost like if a bomb goes off in the first scene, it might seem harder for two fingers brushing against each other to seem dramatic. But if, like, the whole, you know, book has been two people yearning for each other, then that can be like, oh my God.
So here at the moment, everybody I follow on Twitter is obsessed with Normal People of the Sally Rooney.
I knew what you were going to say.
And I feel as though that falls into that category. Have you read it or watched any of it?
No, I haven't read Normal People. I read, is it Conversations with Friends?
Yes.
Yeah, which I liked a lot. Yeah, I think I read maybe a story. Like, I feel pretty confident that I would like any book she wrote.
I was Zooming one of my sisters last night and we were talking about it and we were like, oh, you know, quite tired, let's go to bed. And one of us mentioned something about like watching Normal People and it was like another hour of us analyzing that.
How many sisters do you have?
I've got five.
Oh my goodness. And were you all on the call?
Four out of five. Well, no, five out of six was managed. One sister had to work late.
Wait, so do you have any brothers?
No, all
girls. Six sisters. And what number are you?
I'm the eldest.
Oh.
I'm Jane Bennett, which sucks. Oh my God, Eligible. I can't believe we've not talked about Eligible yet. How much did you care about Jane Austen as a reader growing up? Because I think it's so fantastic and so faithful. I hope you take this as the compliment it is intended to be, but I feel like it is as faithful as Clueless is to Emma, and I think that is a very pure line.
So I read it for the first time when I was, I think, 16, and loved it. And so I guess, I don't know, it's, writing is such a strange thing, because, you know, writing is really something I do by myself. And I know that I'll eventually have an audience for my work. And I'm conscious of that. Like, it would be, you know, kind of disingenuous to say, like, I just do it for my own hobby or whatever. And, you know, who cares what anyone thinks? Like, I know it's, I almost think of it as if I'm, and you should take this in the context of knowing, like, I'm not a good cook at all, and I almost never cook. Like, I do the grocery shopping and my husband does the cooking, but so I almost feel like writing a book is like, you know, preparing for a dinner party, and like, I'm in the kitchen by myself all day, and then everyone comes, and it's a sort of different experience to be getting it ready and like trying different things, and it's kind of like a private or solo experience, and then there's like the public aspect of it. And so, like, if I'm sitting in my office or sitting at my desk, I do feel like I can do whatever I want, you know. It's like, it's almost like the way like a person might like dance in front of the mirror, and then I need to kind of think about what I can live with when the pages that I've written, you know, are going to be public. But I don't know, like, if someone said, you're no Jane Austen, that wouldn't really upset or offend me. Like, I would think, of course I'm no Jane Austen, you know, like, and I just feel like, you know, you could really, as a writer, second guess yourself to the point of like being immobilized in terms of wondering if what you're doing is going to be interpreted as you intended. And I think this is true for Eligible and for Rodham. And I think that it's just kind of crazy making to sort of not assume people's good faith interpretation, even though, I mean, there's like lots of kind of public ugliness and ugly discourse out there. But I think it's like, do you, you know, play to that or try to anticipate that? Or do you just say, like, whatever I do, I'm going to get some criticism and I'm just going to kind of write the best book I can write and the book that really engages me? And I would say that that's what I do.
It still kind of hits me in waves sometimes that it's like, no one expects you or anyone to, like, you don't have to complete books. You're not aiming to write the book that means that no more books need to be written. It's just a perspective that people will enjoy and interpret and be moved by in a thousand different ways. And they're all going to be bringing themselves to that.
Yeah. Well, I you know, don't have as many siblings as you do, but I do have three. And so I feel like when I was growing up, like sometimes if I was maybe in college or something, my family, the six of us, would try to find a movie that we would want to go see around Christmas. And it was very hard to even find a movie that all six of us were willing to see. And then it was very rare, if we did find one, that there was a sort of consensus opinion on the quality of it. And so I just feel like, you know, of course some people like my books and of course some people don't. Like there's no other possibility. Or like any, you know, you could say the most beloved Hollywood star, and it wouldn't be that hard to find people say like, I hate him, or you know, I never liked her. Like it's, people just have different opinions and that's okay.
You know, with Eligible, and I'm so, so glad you did. And, you know, hundreds and thousands of us are so glad you did it. But to go to that story and, you know, rework it and revisit it. And was it, at any point, did it kind of feel daunting?
So that, like the Esquire Hillary short story, and I think this is the only two times this has happened, but it sort of fell in my lap where two British editors reached out to me and said, would you be interested in, you know, writing a contemporary version of Pride and Prejudice? And I think it's exactly what you're saying that sort of made it enticing to me, which was feeling like I'm writing toward a happy ending and I'm kind of playing with this plot that exists, but then I get to make it my own. And it's this kind of, it's making me use my brain in a different way. And it's making me have a sort of combination of creativity, but like homage, or, you know, sort of like borrowing from this book I really like. And I think that I felt all along, like I'm just gonna have fun with this, and that this is an act of admiration. And if somebody chooses to interpret it differently from that, that's okay. Like I mean, I was certainly conscious of the fact that, like, it's because of copyright stuff, it's legal for anyone to write their own Pride and Prejudice, and it was not as if the descendants of Jane Austen like tapped me for this very special honor. Like it's almost just like, you know, I was just amusing myself and maybe some other people.
So I'm doing some ghostwriting at the moment, and it's not quite the same, but it does mean that, like, I've not got to think of the story. The story is there,
yeah.
And I'm just kind of, all I get to do is tell it. But that is the, you know, the thrill and the fun bit and the challenge. And as you say, it's a different way to use your brain, because that you're not using all that power, just kind of thinking, well, how?
Yeah, I've thought that I think I could have been a ghostwriter. And there's a lot of, like, do you know, I haven't read it yet, but do you know that Arielle Levy, who's a really respected writer for The New Yorker, was the ghostwriter for Demi Moore's memoir, and people love the memoir.
Wow. I have not read that, and I would love to read
it. I want to too. Yeah, I'm very curious.
Because I've just finished doing the final copy edits for my first novel, which is out next year. And
congratulations. Oh,
thank you very much. But my main fear, which came to pass, was like all the way through, any time I've mentioned like a time, I'm super, super vague, because I'm like, oh, I'm so, so scared people will go for dinner in October and they'll come out and it's March. Or
oh, that's funny. Yeah managing that is one of the more challenging parts of writing a novel. Like sometimes I use real calendars, like I'll print out a calendar from like October 1997 or something. And I'll think like, oh, this, you know, this has to go in this order just for some plot reason, but it's like impossible. And like, it's chronologically impossible. And there's a few things where I'll think like, ugh, like I hope nobody pays attention. But if they say that doesn't make sense, like the answer to that would be like, you are correct. That doesn't make sense.
Because I'm thinking about prep, where I never, ever, ever question this, but like, for Lee, how kind of empty and jarring those weekends were, where, you know, she really, I think, felt, you know, I thought reading it extra, extra alone. But I can imagine being in the position of sort of writing that. But hold on. How many weekends have there been? When's Christmas?
Yeah. No, I do. I look at real calendars to try, or like, because I also, I think that's an example. Like sometimes people will say like, oh, you should know all your characters' beliefs, or like there should be, you know, like you should have all this knowledge of your characters, even if it's not on the page, because it'll inform how you depict them. And I feel sort of like, I feel that way actually about the calendar in your books. Like you should clearly know when things happen, even if you're not saying it was, you know, March 18th or whatever.
Going back to short stories, I know you mentioned Alice Munro and the New Yorker fiction. Have you read any short stories lately that you love? Or are there any writers who haven't written short form fiction that you're aware of and you'd love to read their short form fiction?
Oh, interesting. I mean, I'm reading a book. A friend of mine gave me a book called Bobcat by a woman named Rebecca Lee, which I think is really, it's really good. And my friend couldn't believe that I had never heard of Rebecca Lee. And it's a writer friend. So I thought like, ooh, that's always a good kind of, recommendation. Joseph O'Neill, whenever he has a story in The New Yorker, I always think that it's excellent. I think he might be Irish, actually, if I'm not mistaken. I've never met him. There's a writer, I think her name is Laura Vandenberg. I think she writes very interesting short stories. Are you familiar with the Best American Short Stories anthology? And I actually was the guest editor this year. So I just read 120 short stories by all different writers.
Are there any characters in your books that where you'd like to kind of revisit?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, with my short stories, there's at least one story where I have thought of like not writing a novel, but maybe writing another short story about the person who's featured in that one. And there are times when I think, I mean, again, to go back to like if I'm like writing about like grouchy, white, educated Midwestern women, like at some point it's like, is this a different one or is this the same? You know, should I just, but usually, I mean, I think that I do write to kind of like entertain myself. And so the aspect of keeping things fresh and new makes me more interested in my own material.
That you've got to want to be spending time with these people you're inventing. And I suppose you get to a point where you're like, I've spent enough time with them already.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you ever reread books? Are you a comfort reader? And are there any books that you're reaching for to be comforted by the familiar?
I'm mostly not a comfort reader and not a rereader. I do sometimes reread Alice Munro stories. And I always, I mean, partly because there is a similarity to her stories. Like sometimes I'll think, I know I loved that one, but like, which one was that about like, a woman in rural Canada and, you know, the sort of secrets that she has. And so I'll reread it. And then I often will think like, oh my God, this is even better than I remembered, or this is more complex, or, I see this in a different way. Like I read this 18 years ago, and now that I have children myself, I see it really differently. So she's kind of the exception to the general rule for me, that I'm just, it's not that I am unwilling to reread, but usually I'm just very curious about books I haven't read.
Yeah. And have you ever given up on a book and then tried again? I just read How to Be Both by Ali Smith, and I tried to read it 5 years ago when it came out, and I just wasn't in the right frame of mind, or I was too immature. I don't know, but I thought, oh, I cannot get on with this isn't for me. And I had to read it again because I was on the Women's Prize podcast, and we've had to sort of talk about all of the books that won, and I was really, really dreading reading it because I thought, I remember not liking this, and I loved it.
I'm not a completist. I do stop it, like sometimes I'll stop within a few pages, sometimes I'll even there are times when I'll read like 150 pages of book, and I do feel like, yeah, I should just finish it, but then I still don't. I mean, it depends on the book. It's funny, I had that experience with Raymond Carver, where I read his short stories as a student and didn't like them. And then probably 10 years later, or maybe even just like 5 years later, when I myself was in graduate school, I taught them to undergrads. And because they're sort of deceptively simple, or like they're not intimidating to students, even if they aren't big readers. And I was able to really see and appreciate the stories in a completely different way. And so like, I think that students were sort of confused and intimidated by Alice Munro, but they were not confused and not intimidated by Raymond Carver. The funny thing is there are, sometimes I'll be sent, especially like an early copy of a book, like before it's published, I'll start reading it, I don't like it, and then like 6 months later it comes out and gets a ton of buzz, and I think I must have missed something, and I'll start reading it again, and I'll feel exactly the way I felt before. Like, I would say that is a more common experience, where again, it's just, I mean, taste is subjective, so it doesn't mean that I'm right and everyone else is wrong. It just means that the book is not my cup of tea.
Do you do what I do, which is furiously WhatsApp my closest, bitchiest friends and say, everyone loves this book, I don't get it. Do you,
yeah.
You know, that's yeah, what you'd like. Yeah, it's the Emperor's New Clothes. It's got to be the Emperor's New Clothes.
Yeah, I know. I feel like there would be like, you know, there's all these sort of texts and DMs of among writers that are sort of like, oh my God, this is nonsense, or like, this is so overhyped. And but yeah, there's not really any good reason for me to ever express that in a public way.
Huge thanks to Curtis. You can order Rodham as an ebook or audiobook and have it in your eyes and ears on May the 19th, or pre-order the hardback, which is coming in July. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow spine crackers. You can find the podcast on social media at YBooked. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at ybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with this from R.L. Stine. People say, what advice do you have for people who want to be writers? I say, they don't really need advice. They know they want to be writers, and they're going to do it. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.